Hello and welcome to the Licensed to Queer podcast, where we're on a mission to uncover why James Bond appeals so much to LGBTQ plus people. Why not see 007 from a different angle? Queer Review of The Spy Who Loved Me, written and read by David Lobergellis. Queer pride and national pride rarely go hand in hand. So why does everybody love The Spy Who Loved Me? Bond has always embodied his nation, and this film in particular, released in the Queen's Silver Jubilee year, puts both Bond and Britain on top, in more ways than one. This cinematic male power fantasy should send running any viewers who don't identify with harder versions of masculinity, especially those which are intertwined with a hardline loyalty to country. But there's something about Roger's third entry that makes all of us, including Queens and the Queen herself, just keep coming. But James, I need you.
So does England.
Bond, what the hell do you think you're doing?
Keeping the British end up, sir.
English proverb. Lie back and think of England. The Spy Who Loved Me begins with Bond brushing off a Russian spy, choosing country over coitus, and ends with him keeping the British end up over another Russian spy. By bookending the film in this way, the filmmakers explicitly link nationalism and masculinity, two things which are inherently intertwined, according to acclaimed lecturer of international politics, Koen Sloopmakers. And the overridingly memorable image of the film, a Union Jack floating down the screen, accompanied by Carly Simon telling us that nobody does it better, quite literally unites Bond's unparalleled male potency with that of his country. But we should be careful when we talk of masculinity. It's not just one thing, not homogenous or hegemonic. And it's not exclusive to men, of course. Women and non-binary people can have masculine qualities, just as men can have feminine qualities. When we speak of masculinity, we should do so in the plural, masculinities. Like all the interesting parts of life, it's a spectrum. For me, anyway, The Spy Who Loved Me marks the point where Bond edges closest to the harder, even hyper-masculine end of this spectrum, potentially making it harder for some queer viewers to identify with him. It can sometimes feel like overkill, especially when it comes to his sexual conquests, as if Bond is trying too hard to prove something, perhaps even putting on a brave show of it. This performative aspect, though, provides a way in for those of us who spent portions of our lives trying hard to conceal parts of ourselves. Furthermore, several stylistic choices, as we shall see, encourage us to not take Bond's hyper-masculinity all that seriously. As a child who didn't like sport or any typically manly pursuits, Bond films did a lot of the heavy lifting for me, providing me with an alternative model of masculinity. And in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when I was growing up, The Spy Who Loved Me seemed to be on TV more than any other Bond film. So frequently was it shown on ITV that I was convinced Jaws was in almost every Bond film. I was that used to seeing him take up most of the frame on our 21-inch TV screen. I have vivid memories of watching the film over and over again. What I don't have any memories of, though, is feeling like I couldn't connect with Bond, despite the gnawing sensation that there was at least one fundamental difference between me and the spy I loved. Lie back and think of Russia. When we first meet Bond, he's with a lady. I'm already struggling to avoid slipping into the mindset and voice of Alan Partridge, for who this is the greatest film of all time, and for once, Alan is not far off the mark. Anyway, I digress. Somewhat inevitably, the log cabin girl, played by Susie Vanna, is revealed to be a Russian spy who has used her sexuality to snare Bond. Lie back and think of Russia. When we first meet Bond, he's with a lady. I'm already struggling to avoid slipping into the mindset and voice of Alan Partridge, for who this is the greatest film of all time, and for once, Alan is not far off the mark. Anyway, I digress. Somewhat inevitably, the log cabin girl, played by Susie Banner, is revealed to be a Russian spy who has used her sexuality to snare Bond. The first recorded use of a phrase along the lines of lie back and think of England is in the 1912 journal of Lady Hillingdon, who wrote of her husband, quote, "When I hear his steps outside my door, I lie down on my bed, I open my legs and think of England," end quote. However, the phrase was likely in use for a long time before 1912. It's very revealing of a 19th century mindset, a woman who was expected to tolerate a man's unwanted advances in order to populate the British Empire. The phrase survived in popular usage well into the 20th century and is still widely understood today. There is so much bound up in this phrase, not least of all the queasy-making, non-consensual aspect, and the mostly unquestioned view that a woman's pleasure is subservient to a man's. It also encodes the assumption that a woman should be lying down, passive, while the man should dominate, performing his nation-building purpose from above. In The Spy Who Loved Me, there's no argument that it's Bond, representative of Britain, who is the one in control. He's lying on top of the girl, establishing him as the active partner and therefore the man. His conquering of the log cabin girl asserts Britain's dominance over Russia. The apparently modern associations with being on the bottom, submissive, or the top, dominant, are not new. Thus has it ever been, or at least for the last couple of thousand years. Positions come loaded with meanings. There have been, and still are, many cultures where even a man who is physically on top of another man is not seen as feminine and gay. Only the passive participant gets labelled as such. Being the recipient of a penis automatically makes one the woman, it would appear, regardless of one's actual gender identity. According to some less enlightened corners of the internet, a man's heterosexuality is compromised by pretty much any sexual position other than missionary, as illustrated by this 2021 Reddit post, which went viral, mostly because of how ridiculous it was. Quote, "Girl on top positions automatically make you homosexual. Face sitting, cowgirl, and any other position with the woman on top are fundamentally acts of homosexuality. The male, by being in a sexually submissive position, is engaging in homosexual activity. And conversely, the woman, being in a dominant position, is engaging in lesbianics." Sick. End quote. It's more than a bit pathetic, really, isn't it? This fear of being perceived as feminine, and who cares anyway? Well, it turns out quite a few people do. It's this fear of being thought of as less manly which has always been at the root of homophobia. And it's been wielded as a weapon by manipulative national leaders for millennia. Most nations have, at one time or another, used homophobia as a tool. I'm not talking about just targeting individuals who are actually gay, although that does, of course, happen on a vast, terrible scale. I mean it in the sense that Kuhn Sloopmakers does. Homophobia is a technology utilised by nations to other nations. That sounds slightly confusing, I know, but when we use other with a capital letter, we're talking about a process whereby we position another group of people as them. This then increases the solidarity and national feeling of the people who are doing the othering, creating this feeling of us versus them. Suggesting, or outright stating, that your rivals are gay in order to belittle them and make yourself feel better is not limited to today's school playgrounds. Greek nation-states did it. The Romans honed it. Throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th century, European nation-states whipped up nationalistic fervour by portraying the populace of other nations as more feminine and making their own people feel like the cock of the walk. The British Empire justified colonisation of other nations by arguing that their men were effeminate and weak, particularly India, as Edward Said has observed in his seminal text, Orientalism. More recently, Russian nationalists have attempted to assert their country's masculinity by portraying Western Europe as feminised and weak for its tolerance of homosexuality. That, partly explains all those weird photos of Russian Premier Vladimir Putin expressing his masculinity. Because nothing says grrr like posing with your shirt off, does it? Although there are thousands of gay models on Instagram who do the exact same thing. I'm just saying. A fairly recent development is so-called progressive countries othering those which are less progressive because they have backwards attitudes towards gay people. See, for instance, the language used by the Western media when reporting on the 2022 World Cup being held in Qatar. Jasbir Poir calls this homo-nationalism. It's still using homophobia as a tool to other. Both approaches are, in Slootmaker's phrase, two sides of the same coin. But at the time of The Spy Who Loved Me, it was the earlier approach which held sway. Looking down on anything feminine slash gay went hand in hand with patriotism in Britain and most countries. I mean hand in hand figuratively, of course. Most men of a fiercely nationalistic bent wouldn't be seen dead holding hands in public for fear someone might get the wrong idea. The 1970s had been a transformative but often volatile decade for gay rights in many parts of the world, especially the UK and USA. As we see repeatedly through history, increased rights for any oppressed group leads to greater visibility, which is a good thing, but it also inevitably leads to backlash from sections of the population which feel like their preeminence is under threat. Perhaps because of what was occurring in wider society, the Spy Who Loved Me filmmakers steer away from anything which might leave the audience to consider the possibility that Bond is anything but a warm-blooded heterosexual, albeit one with a pretty vanilla sexual outlook, certainly compared with what had come before with Connery, Lazenby, and even the first two Moore movies. In his 2014 study of how homophobia ebbs and flows over time, David Plummer proposed that nations are always in one of three different modes, all rooted in fear of men, and by extension the nation, becoming more feminine. The first is rejection. People refuse to accept any changes in gender roles. The second is reaction. People are outspoken in their response to changing roles and revert to earlier, even more traditional gender norms. And the third is accommodation, where a shift in gender roles is permitted. It's a misconception that societies progress along a straightforward linear pathway from rejection to reaction to accommodation. Sometimes taking a step forward entails taking two steps back. Following the accommodations of the late 60s and early 70s, including changes in legislation, The Spy Who Loved Me was arguably produced in a reactionary period. To this end, Bond goes out of his way to restate his heterosexual credentials, metaphorically and geographically. The scene where Bond reunites with his university friend Sheikh Hussein in the desert of Egypt is a salient example here. It's a delightful scene, but it's entirely superfluous to the plot. Interestingly, Christopher Wood did not include it in the novelisation of his own screenplay. The only purpose of the scene is to give Bond another treasure to delve into. A less heteronormative possibility that surely crossed the mind of Christopher Wood was to have Bond acquainted with more than one treasure. After all, the tent is full of them. In a comparable situation, Connery had slept with two girls simultaneously in From Russia with Love. And Lazenby wasn't so much sleeping as spinning plates while disguised as Hilary Bray in Her Majesty's Secret Service. Even more, in his previous film, shared a bed with Andrew Anders while Mary Goodnight was stuck in the closet in the same bedroom. The Spy Who Loved Me, though, is strictly heteronormative, non-monogamy aside. One man and one woman. Penis in vagina intercourse between two people is the only option here. There are relatively few references to other kinds of sex act, even in Bond's witticisms, which in other films encompass less heteronormative acts, such as oral sex. There are few concessions to female sexuality. When M barks an order to Moneypenny for her to relay to Bond, tell him to pull out immediately, he inadvertently makes a pun about coitus interruptus. His words are focused on the agency of the male organ. And even though Moneypenny modifies M's wording when messaging Bond, 007 to report HQ, comes through on the ticker tape, Bond himself reinforces the connection between his penis and his duty to Queen and Country when he tells the girl something came up. Is the implication that Bond is even more turned on by doing his duty than he is an attractive woman? When the Liparis is destroyed, this does reassert male dominance, but for the whole third act of the film, a lot of the film's tension relies on us feeling uncomfortable that the men may not end up on top. Bond and the crews of the UK and US submarines have been subjugated by a symbol of labial feminine power. It's curious that none of the crew of the Russian submarine are featured in the final battle. Are we to assume that they refused to give up and were all gassed to death by Stromberg's men? Rather than a narrative gap, it's far likelier they were omitted on purpose. If they had been present throughout the fight and ultimate victory, they would upset the schema of the whole film, diluting the film's feeling of UK-US national pride. According to the director Lewis Gilbert, the masculine symbol being swallowed by a feminine symbol intentionally recalled his previous Bond film, You Only Live Twice, which had space capsules being engulfed in a similar manner, reducing the male potency of the world powers they belonged to. And if you think I'm taking this subtext too far, I warmly encourage you to read the work of Carol Cohn, an expert in the field of defence, or my summary of Carol's work in my queer review of You Only Live Twice. Delving Desert and Desert. We're getting ahead of ourselves. We're still, for no good reason, in the desert. A delicious irony of the superfluous scene with Sheikh Hussein is Bond appearing in full Lawrence of Arabia garb, as the screenplay puts it. Lawrence himself was, of course, a very queer figure in real life who wrote openly about his same-sex attraction and sadomasochism. Later, the soundtrack quotes Maurice Jarre's theme from David Lean's film about Lawrence's wartime experience. This was a tongue-in-cheek addition by a young editor assembling the film, but the director found it so amusing it was kept in. It's not unusual for Bond to think of women as disposable pleasures, although it would take another 30 years for a woman to put him quite this bluntly on screen. But The Spy Who Loved Me pushes this disposability to extremes. In the very next scene, hundreds of miles away in Egypt, but barely moments later in screen time, Bond finds himself in yet another honey trap. Appearing to have fallen into the trap set by the, quote from the screenplay, generously endowed Felica, Bond commodifies her as foodstuff. Quote, I had lunch, but I seem to have missed dessert. Before she is quickly dispatched, Bond throwing her in the path of Sandor's bullet and dumping her lifeless onto the bed. You're such a charmer, James. The dessert line does not appear in the screenplay, perhaps being added during shooting. It draws our attention to the brief interval, in film time at least, since Bond lasted some delving. The screenplay does show that originally the scenes were in a different order, with Stromberg's introduction coming in between the delving and dessert scenes, thus making it feel like Bond had more time to recover his appetite. The finished film wants us to think of Bond as a superheroic sex machine, the ultimate in straight male virility. When a British broadcaster promoted their upcoming TV screening of The Spy Who Loved Me in the early 1980s on billboards around London, they did so with an advert that read, "A British spy who prefers women? It must be fiction." While this would be unthinkable today, it was a joke that would not have gone over the head of anyone living in Britain at the time. According to 007 magazine, quote, "London Weekend Television, ITV franchise holder for London and the Home Counties, often used the screenings of James Bond films to poke fun at the establishment during the 1980s and tied in the screenings with topical news stories of the day. Moles in the Secret Service and gay spy revelations were cleverly disguised as advertisements for the screening of the Bond film," end quote. By the 1980s, gay spy revelations were not particularly revelatory. Was anyone genuinely surprised when another one made the headlines? Writing in 1997, espionage historian Philip Knightley asserted that, quote, right from their formation in 1909, Britain's secret services have been thick with homosexual officers, as has the opposition, end quote. And while it would take until the 1990s for queer spies to be able to serve openly, Knightley says, the secret worlds of spying and homosexuality have always gone well together. The character of Bond himself emerged and thrived at a time when gayness and spying were inextricably linked in the public consciousness. Perhaps part of the success of the Bond character can be attributed to his novelty value. A straight spy! Who would have thought it? Only months before Fleming wrote Casino Royale, there had been the high-profile defection of gay spymaster Guy Burgess, who is explicitly mentioned by Fleming in both From Russia with Love and The Man with the Golden Gun. The scandal significantly informed the plot for the former novel. Gay spies were on the minds of cinemagoers when the film of From Russia with Love was released because of John Vassal, who was photographed by the KGB in compromising positions with men after being lured into a honey trap by a mystery man he referred to as the skier, which always brings to mind The Spy Who Loved Me, Sergei, to me. And we'll be discussing him in the villains below. And if you want to know more about John Vassal, I explored him in detail in the From Russia with Love queer review. The KGB pulled similar honey trap tricks with Jeremy Wolfenden in the 1960s. The son, as it turns out, of the man who would give his name to the report recommending decriminalisation of homosexual acts. The younger Wolfenden, Jeremy, came out to his father, aged 18, after being thrown out of Eton, shades of Bond here, for offering support and encouragement to other gay students. After university, he had been recruited by MI6. Philip Knightley gives a vivid account of what happened next when Wolfenden headed out to Moscow as a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. Quote, the barber for the Soviet Ministry for Foreign Trade seduced Wolfenden on KGB orders. Just as they were going to bed in Wolfenden's room at the Ukraine Hotel, a KGB photographer jumped out of the wardrobe and said, Alya, alya, shkutya, tu proskodit? Literally, hello, hello, what's going on here? As he photographed them, end quote. And apologies to any Russian listeners of Licensed to Queer for my horrendous pronunciation there. To his credit, Jeremy Wolfenden told his MI6 bosses immediately what had happened, and they asked him to be a triple agent. Although this did not become public knowledge at the time, when The Spy Who Loved Me was released, honey-trapping gay Western agents was a well-established tool in the KGB's arsenal. Between the release of The Spy Who Loved Me and its first TV broadcast on the 18th of March 1982, another of the Cambridge spies, Sir Anthony Blunt, was publicly outed. And in 1985, seven young British service personnel were put on trial for allegedly passing secrets to the enemy while stationed in Cyprus, having been discovered several years previously. They were, according to the prosecution, blackmailed into doing it, at least initially, after one of their number was photographed having sex with men. Although the trial, the longest and most expensive spy trial in British history, although it's little remembered today, resulted in them being acquitted, it renewed the public's association with gay sex scandals and spying. Being openly gay was of course illegal in both military intelligence and the British armed forces at the time. There are, we are led to believe, no gay service personnel in The Spy Who Loved Me, or at least no British ones. The film opens with a freshly awake Navy rating making his way from the bunks to the canteen. The screenplay for the film describes a scene prior to this where he's, quote, reading a girly magazine and reacting with a very carry-on-ish quaw to what he sees. What does survive from the screenplay to the finished film is the walls, quote, plentifully decorated with pin-ups. Just in case we are at all uncertain, this is a hyper-masculine, heterosexual world. In novelising his script, Christopher Wood took the opportunity to turn The Spy Who Loved Me into something Fleming might have written. The first half of the novel is notably different to the film and is quite revealing in the way the cinematic world of Bond had diverged from Fleming's books in order to move with the times. The book features a particularly jarring and Fleming-like scene where Bond, captured by Anya's male accomplices, is tortured. They send electric shocks through his testicles. The description of Bond's clothing being removed is uncomfortably homoerotic, akin to the carpet beating of Fleming's Casino Royale. It would take nearly three decades for the filmmakers to have the gall to put such a literal castration threat on film, in Daniel Craig's first film. Had they shown the Russians torturing Bond, back in 1977, representative of Britain, and with Bond eventually overcoming his torturers, it would have reinforced the film's Rule Britannia sensibility. Writing about the way sexual violence is portrayed in the media, sociologist Dubravka Zarkov notes that, quote, "The castration of a single man of the ethnically defined enemy is symbolic appropriation of the masculinity of the whole group. Sexual humiliation of a man from another ethnicity is, thus, a proof of not only that he is a lesser man, but also that his ethnicity is a lesser ethnicity." By maintaining a functioning pair of testicles, Bond retains his British superiority over the weaker and therefore feminized Russian enemies. That at least one of the torturers appears to gain some kind of pleasure from his job. His eyes glisten lasciviously as he watches Bond's underwear being removed by his partner, cements the connection between weakness and homosexuality. Bond emerges victorious, with his sexual organs and heterosexuality intact. And now let's go back for a final time to that vitally important scene in the ski chalet in Berngarten. Like the film, the novelization begins with Bond being almost honey-trapped by a beautiful spy. But it's a far creepier scenario in the book. Bond discovers in a wardrobe the corpse of the chalet's former female occupant before he even has a chance to get anywhere near a bed or a fur rug. The film's version of this event would appear to be more typically heteronormative and hypermasculine, with Bond getting the opportunity to enlarge the girl's vocabulary by slipping his tongue into her mouth, a family audience substitute for penis in vagina intercourse. And the aforementioned positioning of their figures reaffirms that Bond is in control. It appears to scream, "Not a hint of femininity here!" But wait. Seconds after Bond has zipped up his bright yellow ski suit, we get a wry little musical flourish, or sting, on a muted trumpet, punctuating Bond's statement that his country needs him. The moment could have been played sincerely, with a more heroic, nationalistic brass fanfare to reinforce the connection between nationalism and heterosexual masculinity. Instead, we get a wink to Hollywood's golden age composers, like Max Steiner and Eric Korngold, who would herald the arrival of British armed forces in movies with such musical motifs. By 1977, it was a cliché that could not be taken seriously, harking back to an earlier age. Therefore, the flourish undercuts any sense of male posturing and nationalistic prowess. Bond, it says, and Britain, who he represents, are not to be taken entirely seriously. They are both relics of an earlier age. But crucially, this mickey-taking doesn't prevent us from cheering when Bond's Union Jack parachute opens up at the end of the sequence. If anything, the musical moment, the sting, actually gives us permission to relax and buy into the world of the film. Much as we might love both Bond and Britain, they are not hallowed, po-faced institutions. We can laugh at them as well as with them. The Spy Who Loved Me gives us jubilee-infused nationalism with a coating of iconoclasm. Even queer viewers, justifiably cautious of being betrayed by institutions, cannot help but feel a swelling of pride. The film pulls the same trick right at the finale, At the risk of ruining a very funny punchline by over-explaining it, Bond telling the Minister of Defence that he's keeping the British end up, sir, is as much about maintaining the preeminence of his nation as it is sustaining an, erection. Especially as he's addressing his comment to his superiors. But just as we might be at risk of construing Bond's comment as an assertion of his dominant, nationalistic, heterosexual masculinity, a sublimely silly arrangement of the title theme kicks in. The chorus of male voices makes me picture a crew of sailors camping it up like the titular chorus line in Marvin Hamlisch's 1975 musical. It singularly subverts any sensation of jingoism and hypermasculinity, leaving the film wide open for queer appreciation. Considering how hypermasculine Bond is in this film, or at least appears to be, there's quite a lot to say about the character here from a queer point of view. There's not quite as much to say about the allies in this film, but join us for the much briefer part two of the Spy Who Loved Me Queer Review podcast coming up very shortly.